The expectation that patients should give away their expertise because they are passionately helping other people with healthcare is kind of the same reason that people hate pharma companies, right? It's like, I'm sick, you should give me a drug that I need. What do you mean you need $100,000 a year? That's crazy. You know, at some level, what you're describing is the same feeling as, wait, you're here to help people, and how can you make money doing that and still be genuine and altruistic in your goal? Well, there has to be a balance there.
This is Tectonics, the podcast focused on the people and passion at the intersection of technology and health.
Each of us has, at some time, been a patient in the medical system, but some people have such extensive experience as a patient that their thoughts translate to meaningful expertise. WeGo Health's Jack Barrett is helping these patients turn their expertise into action.
This is Tectonics. I'm David Shaywitz.
And I'm Lisa Soonan, and today's episode is brought to you by AARP Market Innovation, which works to spark innovation in the market that will benefit the quality of life for people over 50. So, David.
Yes, Lisa?
You are really something today, I got to tell you. Have you ever been a patient and wanted to tell the world about your experience? Is that something you've ever been on that side of it all?
I think everybody who's had any interaction with either by themselves or with a family member, God forbid, in a hospital, you're incredibly struck by the difference between sort of the idealized view of medicine and how someone's supposed to get care and what actually happens and just all the complexities and the messiness. If there's one almost feature of medical Twitter, it's everyone like Ashish Jha and every person. You wrote a wonderful piece about this. I mean, it was unfortunate what you went through, but the way you captured it was so vivid about what you expected to have happen and then the actual just kind of gross messiness of the experience.
Yeah, no, I think it's becoming more and more common to see people, you know, open up about their medical experiences. I think it's particularly interesting when doctors do that. But Jack Barrett, our guest today, has been thinking about how to communicate about healthcare for a long time, and particularly through the patient's eyes, even back when healthcare marketing was considered tacky and seedy and you never heard from the patient. But Jack has seen that thinking change and has played a role in the change itself. And today he makes a market for patients who are both seeking information and for providing it to the very healthcare system players who try to serve them. So, Jack, welcome to the show today. We'd love to hear you talk about healthcare marketing's change or evolution from tacky and seedy to acceptable, assuming you think that change has occurred.
That's news to me, by the way, Lisa.
Always an open question. Lisa and David, thanks so much for having me. The move from tacky to seedy, I was part of the tacky seedy era, you know, back in the 80s when it was really very unseemly for a physician to let the world know that he or she existed, or for a hospital to say, maybe you should come here for the best heart surgeons. You know, fast forward and there's billboards everywhere, fast forward and you cannot possibly watch the news right now without seeing Irma and then five drug ads. So it's certainly gotten more accepted. I don't know that it's necessarily gotten all that much more effective. So I think there's always that difference in our society where does repetition make it less seedy? Maybe, but I think it's more that we've been desensitized to the fact that there's healthcare marketing all around us. And part of it is that these kinds of ads that you see, as you said in the outset, aren't really designed to speak to the patients necessarily, right? They're somehow created in a vacuum, maybe in Manhattan somewhere with Don Draper types and regulatory people trying to figure out how to say the word, you know, get better without really implying that you actually will get better because the FDA wouldn't like that. So there's lots of challenges, but it's still a fun
space. Well, look forward to getting to this story and also hopefully to getting to why I can't watch sports with my kids without an ED ad coming on. But
exactly.
Let's start at the beginning, or at least going back a little bit. You've told us that you had a unremarkable childhood in Boston, but a somewhat formative experience in your first healthcare marketing gig at the Tufts Center for Nutrition and Aging. What did you learn there?
Before I left undergrad at Tufts, I started working in public relations at Tufts Medical Center and actually helped to open the Tufts University Nutrition Center and was very proud of that experience. You know, from there, I think the experience that I found most formative, I was hired by a large, at that time, brain injury rehab company that in the early days of the rehabilitation business being funded actively by Medicaid and Medicare especially, but also insurance funding had really freed up in the mid-80s now. And you know, what occurred there was a gold rush of people who had been in the nursing home business, which is always an interesting business unto itself, who said, boy, we can now take the same bed and maybe build some other shiny new facilities and charge multiples of what we can charge an old person to a young person who's been brain injured.
That's not a little bit cynical.
Well, so that's the business rationale, right? And maybe the reason that I recite it that way is that the company I worked for was very aggressive in its marketing communications. I'm proud of the experience of letting the world know this company existed. Fast forward, I learned a lot of lessons about what it means to truly be mission driven as a healthcare marketer, communicator, and now CEO, because that company clearly had a reputation of putting the business side of the business before the patient side of the business. And the formative experience that picture a guy who's in his mid-20s, who's the head of marketing communications for now a national company, greeting the FBI at the door of the company headquarters. Everyone else is gone, by the way. I'm there in my suit, because you still wore suits back then, and saying, here's, okay, guys, come on in. They're like nice jackets. And of course, the media have been called by the FBI to also show what's happening, when to deter others from potentially committing Medicare, Medicaid fraud. This company was never, by the way, indicted in any way. But for me, it was an experience in, when you are clearly focusing on the business part of healthcare instead of the healthcare part of healthcare, and especially the patient side of healthcare, eventually it will catch up to you. And that's not something that has been forgotten as I've gone forward.
Wow.
The mission of what we do is been center, right? So if that was formative, maybe transformational.
Well, I think this tension between, healthcare business interests and patient interests remains as problematic today in some ways as it ever was. Maybe you don't see, like back in the 80s, I also remember there were, psychiatric institutions literally taking patients up off the street and bringing them there to get reimbursed. We don't see that these days. At least we don't think we do. But, how does this tension playing out now in a world of value-based care? Do you think the ethics follow the financing shift or no?
I certainly hope so. I have seen, we feel a dramatic shift in the genuine desire of companies, even who are clearly businesses, right? These are wanting to understand and collaborate with patients, but there's a huge gap between that desire and even saying things like we're patient centric and those who are doing it, and that's where there's still a gap right now. I feel like the ethics have improved dramatically, and frankly, a lot of regulation has taken place and changed, and some of those deterrent actions, like the FBI showing up at places that don't do it right, have had a good effect. So funny how that'll happen.
The start of a very bad day.
Yeah, exactly.
I was actually with a company where that happened as well. I was on the board, and it was something, I tell you.
Yep.
Do you think that the healthcare industry started to think about consumers back then, or is it a pretty recent? And I think about, consumers from a doing the right thing standpoint. Or is that a recent occurrence, or has it happened at all? I mean, is that a universal shift, do you think, in thinking, or no?
I do think it's shifting. I'm actually reasonably optimistic about the fact that patients have become healthcare consumers, right? I think that's something that we all talk about and we wish they would be. But, the reality is that our parents were childlike in their obedience to their physicians and kind of the healthcare hierarchy overall, including what the hospital told them to do and pay and what insurance to buy through their employer, that the genuine involvement of patients as healthcare consumers is really very different. And I think a lot of that's being driven by digital health companies, like, we talked about GoodRx, my friend Doug Hirsch started, which is just a way for transparency and pharmaceutical pricing to occur. And suddenly consumers are saying, well, these are the kinds of tools I'm used to using for everything from hotel rooms to car repairs. Now I've got it for Rx and I can act like a consumer. So there is a shift there, and there's no question that feels right.
If you look at the continuum, say, from the sort of old school paternalistic setup that you initially described to maybe the future vision that someone like Eric Topol captures in his books, The Doctor Will See You Now, how far along in that spectrum do you think we currently are?
That's a great question. I feel like we're at the cusp of, of consumer enlightenment in healthcare, that we're not quite there yet, but that, you know, again, I'm so encouraged by what digital health is about to make possible by making user-friendly and consumer-understandable the hairball that's healthcare, right? That you know what?
Well, I'm going to take issue with your optimism, I think, because I still see most of these companies that are, well, all of these companies that are direct-to-consumer, you know, information, product, whatever, failing. You know, they can't build large paying customer bases, with rare exception, very rare. Like, I don't think I could name one off the top of my head.
Good thing you're not in the business of investing in these.
You know, I still hear people, you know, including my, you know, allegedly intelligent and educated friends, when I say to them, oh, Jesus, you just got a diagnosis of XYZ, you know, have you gotten a second opinion about the treatment that they're going to do to you? No. You know, I think it's still so paternalistic. And so people are so willing to be told to what to do by, you know, Dr. XYZ.
But just before here, we, of course, we would love to have you answer the question, but I want to push back on just a touch of this, is how much of what doctors are doing is actually taking, with patients' permission, some of the burden off of them of that. I mean, Atul Gawande has written very thoughtfully about this, the idea of that. I mean, I think as a marketer, you must have to, you know, deal with this tension of the fact that there's an overwhelming amount of stuff people deal with when they're sick, and something that you get when you go to a good doctor or go to an expert is someone to offload some of that responsibility and to take care of it and to sort of to provide advice about what to do.
Well, the doctor-patient relationship is one that, well, my doctor is Danny Sands, so I have this kind of unfair view of reality, of course, but I really do feel that the conversation being a conversation in a partnership is evolving, and some of it because there is so much information being pushed at patients as consumers, they're beginning to take that participatory relationship. I love the Society for Participatory Medicine, although I can never say it. But I really do feel like that change is occurring. And but by the way, without much participation by doctors for the most part, right? Many I still see Danny as the vanguard, right? As one who is a very participatory guy. But he and Dave are still telling the story of what it's like to really collaborate with your doctor. But at some point, every physician has to say, and I can't remember who really penned this quote because it was not I, but you know, that any physician who can be replaced by a machine probably should be. And and it's exactly the point that what would be more fun for physicians than not having to go through the basic BS of like, okay, when was left, are you allergic to antibiotics and all that stuff that gets in the way of actually knowing the human that's in front of them and talking about what's unique to their situation, which is the craft and the art of being a doctor versus the basic rudimentary differential diagnosis stuff, which a machine can do better, right? One of the things that inspired me early on and even founding WeGo Health was an anecdote, which again, I cannot find appropriate attribution for, of parachuting laptops into mainland China when there was barely electricity, giving it to the healer in a village and kind of going back and finding that when they used differential diagnosis software, about 75% of the time, they got the treatment right. So it was this huge leap from we're guessing and, you know, Western medicine is something that then Eastern medicine is, I actually enjoy the complementary part of it, but all that aside, machines can do a lot of the heavy lifting that shouldn't be what doctors are spending their time doing. They should be doing more important things more collaboratively with their patients. And I think patients welcome that ability to have a conversation about something other than, you know, tell me this, tell me that you told me again, you know, last year.
So, you know, let me use that as a jumping off point to go back in your history a bit, because you were very early to this collision of technology and patients and social media and healthcare, while you were leading Yahoo's efforts to compete with WebMD's original consumer-focused plan. What was that like? Tell us about, you know, marketing, selling, talking, communicating to consumers back then.
Whoa, way back then.
Way back then.
I'm stroking my beard right now, just so you know. Picture we're in Silicon Valley, and you know we're looking at WebMD as number one, and Yahoo Health is number eight in health content views and page views and those kinds of things that matter a lot to media companies. And we said, that's not right. We're the biggest damn health site website in the entire world. We should be number one in health as well. So you know, we set about to create, you know, a fast follower with MD, and I'm very proud of the fact that we got us up to number two behind with MD. That was great, but that wasn't really the most fun discovery of all that. Wasn't how to get more traffic to see more health information and encyclopedic information that was available elsewhere. It was when I went looking for how to integrate the conversations that were happening on Yahoo into the health space, right? So everyone had 7,500 definitions of diabetes and type 2 diabetes. Don't need another one of those. But when you went over to Yahoo Groups and found that there were thousands of groups that had been organically formed and were being led around just depression or just heart disease or just, you know, parenting. So the idea that there was this, you know, organic consumer demand to talk to each other about their health, and that there was, you know, there was a group of people who were by with no compensation and no desire to do anything but help as many other folks as they could, leading all of those groups. That was the most exciting thing that I found at that time. And that was also back when we were going around and giving talks like, what is user-generated content? What is social media? How will it work? Pre-Facebook, right? So what became clear was that social media is, a phrase I like to say a lot is that health is social media's higher calling, right? This is a chance for consumers to work with each other, to collaborate around their overall health, and then to go to their doctor more informed and more help. But to me, that was the exciting part of the Yahoo experience, was finding these people in all the other corners of Yahoo, not necessarily in health, talking about health stuff, and therefore, you know, showing that peer-to-peer communication was incredibly valuable and powerful.
And yet, WebMD and Yahoo and all the others that you know were up there couldn't really make a business out of this, I don't believe. I mean, just didn't, you know, couldn't figure out a way to turn that into income.
Well,
right?
Right. What was true about Yahoo and is still to this day, and WebMD, and now you've got Healthline and Everyday Health and others who are in the space, is that, you know, there's a volume game, which is a media game, right? How many people could we engage in good education information? How do we create more video? That's about how many bodies can we touch at the same time.
But that's to sell advertising, right?
Yes, to sell advertising. Yeah, yeah. But yeah, the piece that I got excited about was that's the relatively small number of people who were the organic leaders in the patient world, who were doing all the heavy lifting. And you know, fast forward, that's who we focus on exclusively at WeGo Health now, is who are those people who have, you know, with their behavior, stuck a hand up and said, I want to help other people with the health condition that I have, more people should know. And those patient leaders, we now have about 125,000 as part of the WeGo Health Network, are reaching, you know, 80-90% of all health consumers with this peer-to-peer conversation every day. So you're right that as a media company, you don't want 100,000 anything, you want 100 million everything. So that was where, that's where I happily left my happy office in Silicon Valley at Yahoo and went to found WeGo Health.
Well, I'm going to be really interested to hear about the vision for WeGo, because I recently I was at a Festival of Genomics conference in
Sounds fun. Festival of Genomics.
You know, we're just it's hot. Lisa. It was so hot.
It's like Burning Man.
I was going to say,
you know,
the Burning Man of DNA.
You know. All right. It's like pearls before. All right. So one of the topics that was discussed was actually the group at Rady Children's was where they're really from the world's experts on these really devastating rare diseases. So there, how are you happening to make fun of that,
fine,
Lisa?
I'm not laughing anymore.
There you go. Okay. But one of the experts that was really talking about the insight that he got from all of the sort of patient communities that he found on organically had formed on Facebook, and what a resource Facebook was turning out to be for patients. And I wrote about this for Forbes about how maybe sort of the tech giant that people don't really associate with being with healthcare, but that really meets consumers where they are, and which they already know how to use, and which they're already participating in, is Facebook.
Exactly.
So I guess a question I would have when you decide to start a business based on this is, sounds good, but isn't it called Facebook? So I'm curious of what you're doing that's in the context of Facebook, for example, that's distinctive and where in sort of competitive in a world where everyone is already comfortable with most people with Facebook.
Well, then they announced this week, Facebook, that they were going to have a clinical trials recruitment product.
Thing, yeah. Because they're already in touch with these patients who are concerned and for this exact reason.
Right. It's a great question. And we look at Facebook as absolutely the number one health platform in the world now, right? It's not WebMD anymore, even if the numbers say that, you know, because that's where most health consumers are having the most health conversations. And we do a lot of work with that. But what we're trying to do is identify those folks who are the leaders on Facebook, and by the way, still on blogs. Remember those, and Twitter and Instagram,
yep.
and all.
We endorse blogs.
Yeah, exactly. I know you do. So put them together and say, how do we problem solve together about being a patient leader in that space or overall as a patient leader? So, for example, you know, one of the things that we've helped our patient leaders through is the reality of Facebook's current advertising model, which took what used to be massive organic influence of a patient leader who would be running a metastatic breast cancer Facebook group who was getting lots of interaction and engagement and shares and all kinds of stuff. And all of a sudden it just stopped. And we were having conversations with groups of folks on Twitter chats or in webinars about what this is what happened to the algorithm, and this is what it means to start paying for your traffic, and reconciling that for our leaders who want to reach as many people as possible, but are often doing this with while battling their own medical financial crisis. So, you know, that's the kind of support we're trying to provide for the patient leaders, which is on Facebook. Here's creative things you can do to keep your traffic building, your community growing. Also looking at best practices like, you know, Facebook Live, who's used it? Is it working well for you? You know, can someone from the diabetes community who does a lot of it help someone from the rare disease community who hasn't done so much of it yet to learn the technology? And you know, even, you know, and other bigger topics which span platforms, so even beyond Facebook, like how do you handle a death in your community? What happens when someone who's been an incredibly visible participant dies? How do we recognize that properly online? Do we all go to their Facebook page? What do we do? So it's in a way, it acts like a trade union, a professional association, however you want to describe it, for the patient leaders who are organically trying to help as many other folks.
I kind of think of it, of WeGo Health, as either a Catalent or a Gerson Lehman Group type of model,
mm-hmm.
for patients, to find patients instead of to find other kinds of consultants. Is that a good characterization? I mean, you're helping them essentially find their market and monetize and build their brand, so they get some of the benefit that they've given out to the world back.
Well, exactly. Yes, that's a good way to put it. I think that the Catalent comparison is particularly good because we're looking for not a typical patient, but the patient expert, right? This is someone with business expertise that is also a patient. And so, I mean, you look at examples like, you know, Leanna Mullen, who did a work on our WeGo Health Experts platform for a company called Brand Trust that was looking for a group of patients in Gaucher's disease to talk to quickly for a research project. Finding Gaucher's disease patients quickly is nigh on impossible. But Leanna is part of that community as a patient leader, and she's a TV station manager. She's a film producer. She's a true business professional. So she was hired by Brand Trust, and within 30 days, she had everyone they needed at about half the cost of what they usually would have spent to do it. So what Leanna really used her business experience and expertise as a professional to get that work done. But the reason that she was particularly valuable was the credential, like it's an odd phrase, but the credential of her disease, right? She came in with that inside knowledge of the community as part of it and was able to deliver that service right away. So getting, you know, making sure Leanna gets some money for that is important.
Does the model create a bit of a conflicted view for these leaders, where on the one hand, they're, you know, are they sort of altruistic leaders trying to organize a patient community out of their passion? At one point, does it sort of cross the line into, well, you know, I'm trying to help a lot of people, which is a great motive, versus by leveraging this, you know, I'm leveraging my, like you're saying, the credibility in a community to, you know, for, you know, sort of for commercial ends?
That's such a weird question to me, Dave. I mean, I get why you ask it, but like if your skill was accounting and you leverage that for the good of the community, you'd expect to get paid for it, right? So why wouldn't some other personal skill be payable? You know, why shouldn't that be payable? And so you get to keep your credibility.
You know, I understand that. I think I can just imagine where if you're somebody who comes to the community and there's somebody who's doing good, at least you'd want there to be transparency that, oh, by collecting or by organizing the effort, the accountant, you know, is getting paid for what they're doing.
Sure.
If somebody is organizing a lot of patients and the public face of it is I'm trying to make the world a better place, I'm trying to do all of this, and then on the side they're getting paid based on the number of hits they get or the number of people who are drawn to it. It seems that you at least want to know about that.
Jack, what are your thoughts?
It's a terrific debate. It's an important one because it's an unusual one in the patient space. So Lisa, I'm obviously on Lisa's side here. What are you, crazy, David? Of course they should be paid for their expertise. But the expectation that patients should give away their expertise because they are passionately helping other people with healthcare is kind of the same reason that people hate pharma companies, right? It's like, I'm sick. You should give me a drug that I need. What do you mean you need $100,000 a year? That's crazy. That, you know, at some level, what you're describing is the same feeling. You say, wait, you're here to help people. And how can you make money doing that if and still be genuine and altruistic in your goal? And there needs to be, there has to be a balance there. And to your point, you know, what we've worked on for many years is you know, the rules of transparency. Part of one of the many things that we are actively working on, and we have a lot of content on our Weak Health Expert site, is how to use FTC disclosure regulations. What it means that you can't just say hash spawn anymore. You have to say ad in the copy as celebrities have learned the hard way, right? So when you're doing if you're a Kardashian, you ignore those rules, but that's a whole other topic. But the reality of you know, teaching patients who are leaders how to stand up and say, I deserve to be recognized for my business value, but I want to also be transparent to my community at the same time. So they know exactly what that, yes, I was paid to create this promotional video and put it up here. And as long as if you're not okay with that, don't watch it. And that is critical because there's a balance there. It's not the same. What we don't want to do is turn into the mommy bloggers who will swap, you know, a blog about shampoo for shampoo.
Well, that was more the point. I mean, it's funny that Lisa and I are on this because whenever we discussed pharma, we're on almost the opposite side of the debate, have the exact opposite question. So actually, it's not a question of what's the value of the market and of encouraging more of this expertise that's out there, but rather of ensuring that there's transparency to the extent that if someone is out there and there's an economic incentive, among other incentives, you're aware of it.
That's right. I'm actually really excited about, to the earlier point about, you know, why isn't digital health catching? Why isn't it being adopted? What's happening that I believe one of the big gaps has been easy access to patient expertise and to patients who can be expert collaborators, but on demand, right? Because it's an overwhelming lift for a digital health startup or to kind of spend time finding the right people, contracting with them, figuring out how to pay them. And I think it was another patient leader who said, yeah, I think it happens that there's a whole day of interaction with patients for an hour of value. And
that sounds to me like efficient.
But you know, when you're in it for a while, you start to come up with these realities of we need to find the and train the patient experts who can contribute as business peers and be available on demand through digital matching platforms. You know, to make that available to the digital health economy, the companies that are trying to do better by creating a better user experience, trying to build adoption by creating programs that create education through patient leaders, that hasn't been easy to do. So taking the friction out of that, I genuinely believe will accelerate the ability of these companies to get adoption, to speak on behalf of the patient and to be accepted by the patient community, which is what's not happening now, right? There's beautiful technology that no one ever thought of how to get someone to use it. We just, you know, pop it up on the App Store or present it at Health 2.0. It's not going to get adopted. It needs to get have patient support behind it, and that starts with patient leaders.
So, Jack, you've made a profitable company from this mission, which may surprise some people. Can you explain the business model? How do you make money helping patients help themselves?
Well, the current model we're excited about is a digital matching platform that works like Upwork or Catalan, where companies will come in and post an engagement saying, and you know, a real example is, a company hired John Rose, who's one of our patient leaders, to find folks in the idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis market, another challenging one. And they wanted someone to find an advisory board for them and recruit an advisory board. So they posted an engagement. It was several thousand dollars. John responded to it with a proposal. He went out and found those people. He was subsequently hired, by the way, to manage the advisory board, not just find it because they liked the experience with him so much. You know, from that transaction, we take a fee from John Rose, the patient leader, because we found him the work, and we take a service fee from the company that hired him. So it's a transactional model for us on putting a lot of people together quickly and frictionlessly in this environment.
That's great. And you said you have 125,000 patients now.
Yeah.
Active in the program?
That's our total network. We're bringing people on to the digital matching platform as hireable experts a little more slowly because it's a marketplace, right? So the general rule of thumb is you want to have three available resources for every one customer. and we don't want to pull that out of balance. And since we only launched in February, we're keeping that under control. We have about 200 clients signed up on the platform since February with scant marketing resources. So it's catching on really well.
So you launched this platform recently, but the company's been around for 10 years. I think it's your 10-year anniversary, right? So what?
That's right.
What changed, and what led you to that change? And now 10 years looking back, what do you know for sure?
Yeah. Well, for 10 years we've been nurturing and fostering this network and funding that with doing largely market research and social media promotional services for big pharma, which has been fine and transparent and gets at a lot of the questions we've been describing. But and it's done a lot to keep our network growing and supported. But what we learned was there are many more than the few thousand people that would be engaged in network every year that want to be involved. And to get to really make the change in healthcare that this force of patient experts can make, we need to find a way to scale that. So the new platform gives us a chance to say, instead of having 2,000 or 3,000 people a year create video or be hired to create blogs or promotions or whatever it may be, or be in a research group, we can now have 10 or 20 or 30 or 40,000 patient experts out there at work, plugged into companies of all size, right? Not, you need to create a model that is affordable for the innovators. So that if there's one lesson, it's if you're going to grow past the big full service kind of model, which doesn't really scale, to one that does scale and really changes the world, you need to create also a price point and a match between what the market needs and what you've got. So we're excited that people are connecting. Small startups are connecting with our members now and saying, I can't believe I have instant access to these people who I wouldn't have met, wouldn't know how to pay, and I could for $1,000 I can have a half-day conversation with the top leaders.
I guess what's so interesting here is, when you're describing this, this sounds exactly to me or very, very similar, like the GLG expert network approach, which like in earlier in my career, I remember both participating in and hiring in various roles.
Right.
And I think, but what's here is this is a patient network, but what you've done is I think the insight, if I'm hearing you right, is either the marketing expertise to call patients experts, or what I would say is actually the real healthcare insight to recognize that actually patients are experts in their own disease, and making the connection between patients are experts and then calling it sort of a patient expert network. I think that's a really interesting concept.
Well, yeah, you've got it exactly. I think GLG is another company to be admired, and patient experts can. What we found is even maybe a tighter Venn diagram, right, is the overlap of people who bring genuine business consulting expertise and their patient expertise to the market. So because we need to really run over that patriarchal approach that patients need to be patted and like a petting zoo, and we study them versus we actually put them at the table with us and hold them accountable for work. And I look at an example is our network director, Julie Cerrone, was a rock star consultant at Deloitte, right? She was running national gigs. She was up till 2 a.m. running teams all over the country, and then was diagnosed with psoriatic arthritis. And as a result, of course, could not pursue that lifestyle anymore, came off, beat her disease enough and managed it enough now that she's now working for us full time. The passion that she brings to her job running our network is a combination of her Deloitte background and the fact that she kicks ass and her passion for helping other people who she knows also have chronic disease. So that those people are out there. There's not a million of them, but there's tens of thousands of them. And that I think that's what surprises the corporate world or even the startup world is these people can sit with you and go toe-to-toe on a business basis and then bring that insider knowledge. That's the fun part for us.
That's great, Jack. I mean, I think it's so inspiring to hear a company that is making a business that not just serves patients, but drives their success, as opposed to a healthcare company that is about conquering patients or taming them or petting them in the zoo, as you put it. I love that analogy.
Yeah, that was great.
So thank you so much for telling us about it today. Really appreciate the insight and the passion you bring to it.
Well, thanks for having me. It is a passion. It's 10 years old and getting younger. So thanks for that.
That's wonderful. Take care. Have a great night.
All right. Take care.
Today's guest, Jack Barrett, was speaking to us from Boston as we sit here in beautiful Tectonic Studio B in Mill Valley, California.
I thought that was such an interesting show and a really interesting example of how of an approach to engaging and organizing patients and trying to make real some of the ambitions of patient centricity.
Absolutely. I mean, I don't know of another business really that has gone straight into it this way. I mean, there's a lot of businesses that collect patients, right?
Right.
Facebook being one, certainly patients like me, there's others. But I haven't seen one that collects patients in a way that's a business benefit to the patient quite the same way.
Right, right. And they seem very comfortable with sort of that orientation.
And I think they should, because I think why, you know, like any expert in anything, why shouldn't they get paid for their time and be easily findable and, you know, like any other consultant and the like? I mean, certainly that's how physicians operate.
Well, and then also how a lot of businesses are interested in their expertise.
Yeah.
So, you know, in that context and with appropriate transparency.
Well, and in a world where things like patient-reported outcomes and user-centered design are becoming more and more common, I think, you know, it leaves a huge opening for something like this. So I'm excited for them to
it's
see them.
It's a new concept.
Yeah, as they move forward. You can follow David's writing at Forbes.
And you can follow Lisa Soonan at VentureValkyrie.com. And also remember, please rate us on iTunes and leave a comment. Help others discover the show.
We're grateful to AARP for sponsoring this episode of Tectonics. AARP's market innovation team works to spark innovation in the market that will benefit the quality of life for people over 50.
Later.
Gator.